Why do you say that, Father? You aren't afraid, are you?
No. But I respect some of the superstitions of others. Often they are founded in fact.
Hi, and welcome to Sorceress, a podcast where I chat with authors and audiobook narrators about books, and especially audiobooks in the urban fantasy category. If you dig wisecracking wizards, conflicted lycanthropes, antagonistic undead, and all those other things that go bump in the night and then get bumped back, you're in the right place. So make yourself comfortable, salt the doors and the windowsills, and join me, James Anderson Foster, as we get to know the creators of this fascinating genre. Okay, so tonight I'm here with actor extraordinaire Neil Heligers. He's a narrator, actor, and educator who lives in Brooklyn, New York. He's narrated numerous audiobooks with a focus in speculative fiction and non, as well as lent voice to various video games and commercials. Recent on-camera work includes roles in CBS's Madam Secretary, Netflix's House of Cards, and NBC's Law & Order SVU. Neil has performed Shakespeare nationally and internationally, and has directed and taught said bard to actors of all ages. He has a BA from the University of Pennsylvania in Theater Arts and Psychology, and an MFA in acting from Trinity Rep Conservatory. Neil, how are you?
I'm very good. That was very well read, James. I really appreciate
Thank
that.
You. Yeah, it makes you sound so fascinating.
I've never heard it. I think I wrote that one relatively recently, and I've never heard it out loud. And it's very helpful because I can think of a few edits I would like to do immediately. Said bard. What the hell? You know, I mean, that was too voicey.
I went with it.
Good. Yeah. No, I mean, you made it work. But for the purposes of hearing it out loud, but seeing that on the page, which I think is just confusing, you know, said bard, what'd the bard say? You have, you know.
So, okay. In my prep for this interview, I know you, I've known you for years now,
yeah.
Oddly enough.
Yeah.
But I still wanted to get up to date on what you've been doing recently. See what's going on
stalking.
On Audible.
Yes, yes.
I was stalking.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah. No, I'm professional. Professionally.
No, that's the whole reason for the podcast.
Right. So, exactly. Yeah.
And it's not stalking if it's research.
Yes.
True. You've got 85 audiobooks listed there, and I started to make note of all of the genre fiction ones, all of the books that might fit into what we want to talk about.
Sure.
And I gave up listing all, it became easier to just list the series instead.
There are a number, yes. There are a lot. There's been a lot of series work, which has been good in terms of, you know, longer story, better story, you know, more.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
You own this genre. Times Like These, which is up, I think, to book four.
Yeah, book four just came out, last week just came out. Yeah. The great time travel series by Nathan.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
Viral superhero series.
Yeah, which I just wrapped one of today. That's the pushing on seven books altogether. And that's Teenage Superhero Saves the World, kind of a Whedon-esque kind of, you know.
As they do,
yeah. I mean, what else are they going to do with the superpowers? and tons of awkward relationship stuff, too, because he's, legitimately a teenager and has, a couple of exes. But, you know, hilarity ensues. And,
nice.
Dark Souls and things like that.
So how does the author capture that whole teenage feel and do a good job?
A lot of really genuinely awkward conversations. You remember how on Friday Night Lights, Coach's daughter, they were oh, she's these conversations are so legitimately awkward teenager. And there was one camp that believed that, and the other camp were maybe she's not as good an actor as everyone else. No, I believe that the awkwardness has to sort of hang out there, and it's juxtaposed in this series with then he uses his powers to stop the, the Lycos wolf demon coming in through the window, very inconvenient at the same time, but he can't, it's a, there's lots of team happening. Are you Team Erica or are you Team Natalie kind of a thing going on? It's conscious of itself, and it's taking place over a few years, and it's current in the sense of dude, this ain't the Hunger Games kind of level of referencing. So, it's fun. It's a lot of fun.
Excellent. Excellent. There's obviously Domino Finn's series, Black Magic Outlaw.
Yeah, which also had another very recent installment as well, Death March. And that's, you know, both of those. Well, in times like these series, that time travel series with Nathan, the Viral Superhero series and Domino series are all independently produced ACX platformed books. And those three series, well, I mean, particularly the ones I started with, which was In Times Like These with the Chronathon 3 years ago, and then Domino not long after that, were sort of the backbone of all the other work that I did coming out of that in terms of, I guess you could call it, we call it branding, but also in terms of the kind of work I wanted to do. In Times Like These is sci-fi, but I think of it as sufficiently advanced technology that is indiscernible from magic. In terms of like how the mechanism that he created for time travel and the stories, you know, he really does have like the best time travel mechanism, like setup, explanation, understanding that I've ever come across. Like, it's really great in terms of like, he doesn't compensate just for time, but location as well. Like, and you think about it, it's like, oh, right, of course, if I were to teleport in this booth 5 minutes ahead in time, like the planet is moving, the solar system's moving, like I wouldn't be right here. I'd be probably fused to like, you know, the Empire State Building or something like that. So he takes that into effect as well, too. But that and then Domino's series, which is a, you know, a blend of all different kind of cultural magics that converge in Miami, which is kind of great. All the different immigrant communities that are there and how they interact with each other and how that kind of enters into an American generation. So the main character is a, you know, he's a necromancer and he has a patron also, and voodoo, and, you know, he interacts with all these different kinds of mythical creatures that kind of converge. Weirdly, In Times Like These takes place around St. Petersburg, you know, on the Gulf Coast of Florida. Mm-hmm. And then Domino series is in Miami, which is like, so on the East Coast. So for a while I was like bopping back and forth between these like different locales in Florida, which is, you know, I mean, I live in New York, so it's a sort of, and my grandmother's down there, so she's very happy about it.
Nice. So, okay. You mentioned that, you know, these series, is sort of formed the backbone of this larger foray into genre fiction for you. Is this, was it consciously sought out by you, or was it, hey, I got this one, I seem to be doing good at it, and then somebody else wanted me to do theirs? Or, you know what I mean? Like, is this a happy accident? Is this I'm good at them, so I keep going? Or are you, you know, a fan of these kinds of books?
I mean, it is by design. I mean, not all the books that I have read or have read are genre fiction, but certainly growing up and by and large, that's, you know, what I consumed in, you know, mass quantities was, you know, fantasy, high fantasy, sci-fi, you know, as, you know, whatever I had time to kind of pour through, starting back, you know, pre-Golden Age for sci-fi all the way through Arthur C. Clarke and all that, and through into the more contemporary, like Alistair Reynolds and things like that. But also on the fantasy side of things, like everyone, you know, like Tolkien as many. But you know, actually, when it comes down to it, I don't think I ever read specifically urban fantasy, or I don't know if urban fantasy was certainly hasn't been as abundant as high fantasy has been, I think. And so when I landed into, like, I want to narrate the kind of books that I want to read, and that applies to genre and the books themselves. And so when I was going into auditioning for these things, I would throw a wider net. I was trying to get myself kind of going, of course, too, but the ones I gravitated towards and, you know, work to get or, you know, work through a few audition rounds of like, yeah, let me take that again. You want that guy like that? Okay. And then built that relationship with those authors. And that had been continually doing books for years, but also, I've kind of like with, particularly again, with those two series, I started doing those books two or three years ago and I do them now and it's like, oh, like that's what 3 years of narrating feels like, or 3.5 years, or however long exactly it's kind of been. But yeah, no, it's by design. I've been more recently starting to do a bit more contemporary fiction, which is kind of nice too, because good writing is good. It's good writing is good. But I still, when I have time to read for pleasure, it's always, you know, it's always, almost always, you know, sci-fi or fantasy or something along those lines, or convergence of the two, if possible. So yeah.
So one of the things I often hear when people talk about sort of contemporary literature is that they enjoy exploring the human condition.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm every time I hear that, it makes me think about genre fiction and, of course, all the other things that get thrown in. We're not just talking about the human condition, but we're also talking about, you know, dead, undead, supernatural, you know, all these other things. And the more I think about it, the more, and maybe this is just me projecting and justifying my passion here, but I find them as interesting and unique ways to explore the human condition in ways that might not be so easy otherwise.
Yes.
And so I guess my question is, are you going to back me up on this?
What the hell are you talking? Yeah, well, I've always felt that. I mean, that's what's great about going back and looking at older sci-fi, is that you see the values of that generation represented in, you know, what they want in the future and certain things that everyone wants, like flying cars, for example. But really just in terms of like how things, where we see ourselves going. And it's inherently, I mean, that's the thing. It's inherently optimistic to be like, oh, I mean, the Earth in 200 years is going to be like this, and not be like, oh, we're not really going to be on Earth in 200 years, you know, and different how different authors treat that. Maybe, you know, Kim Stanley Robinson has got that great, he's got a lot of great books, but he has this great trilogy, Red Mars, Green Mars, Blue Mars, in which it's about the terraforming of Mars, or the era forming, as they eventually start calling it, is making it not just a copy of Earth. And in that, there's a big event where a big ice, you know, well, I can't spoil this too much, but there's something that happens that makes everyone have to go to Mars, basically. And it's not exactly within our lifetimes, but not too far off, you know. And so that's how we, you know, how else are we going to get the message across that these are serious problems unless there's a vivid, evocative, emotionally connected, intellectually supported rendition of this was what's going to happen? You know, like I'm sitting here in Brooklyn. I'm in Park Slope, which means I'm on a hill. So I might be all right. I might be okay. But like, you know, we saw that in Hurricane Sandy, Lower Manhattan, the subways, all that, you know. That's certainly been the case with sci-fi. I think with urban fantasy too, it feels like it's the mirror. I guess it was what I was saying before about Black Magic Outlaw being in a way about the multicultural experience, the melting pot of Miami, and how that figures into all these older traditions and how they've converged. So in a way, I feel like those characters are always looking back because they're always cursed, you know, or, you know, or dealing with old tomes that they don't want around anymore, you know, and that, you know, wanting to, you know, deal with the past as opposed to sci-fi, which is sort of throwing things more into the future, you know, both obviously being equally important. How can you know where you're going if you don't know where you've come from? And how do you know where you're going if you don't know if the planet will be flooded?
Yeah. So sort of playing off on the contemporary lit and genre fiction, you do some stage and screen acting as well.
I have, yes.
You know, your bio also doesn't mention the cameos that you have done. Kimmy Schmidt, seen you on the Late Show. It's when you have a role, at least when I've seen you on TV,
mm-hmm.
you have a type.
Yeah. Well, right. I have a beard. okay. So, I mean, the background about that is that, I mean, yeah, I used to do a lot of stage used to be what I, you know, did was like how I acted, you know, and that was over a number of years after getting out of grad school and, working for Shakespeare festivals, in the New York area or in New York or, touring companies, around the country or a little bit out of the country. And then at a certain point when it was family time to really kind of make that work, I made the decision that that wasn't the path I wanted to maintain. So change over to doing commercial work most often. The idea was on camera work. And that took the form of a lot of like goofy dad. This was like the height of Modern Family. So everyone was looking for Phil to be their family dad guy. And so I didn't have a beard then. because those guys didn't have beards. So that's what I was doing. And it was okay. I was working fairly regularly for that kind of work. You know, at a certain point, I'm like, I need to localize and kind of dig into, like, what is it that I want to really be doing here alongside some of this other stuff. The idea wasn't to cut anything out or any opportunities, but started, you know, working in audiobooks. I did that thing where, you know, I looked up a narrator and who I knew from grad school and like just picked her brain. And so I did that thing in the coffee shop, and she was incredibly gracious enough to like not, you know, to like do accept, and, you know, kind of built things from there. And then, yeah, kind of like kind of sort of pursued everything kind of expanding outward from there. But the idea also was I still wanted to be doing other kind of acting work at the same time. Getting, once I had a son, doing a show was harder and harder for a while. I couldn't travel anywhere. If I was doing Shakespeare, a lot of that work would have been regional, and I'm not going away for 6 weeks or something like that, as much as in some ways I would like to, and maybe I will someday. But it's been about these, yeah, roles. And then once I started narrating, I could grow a beard again, you see. And so that has, I honestly feel like a lot of these roles I've been doing recently are like doctors. Doctor is very, you know, is very, been very consistent. It's been like three or four doctors. And yeah, Kimmy Schmidt was rich guy, you know. I do these like occasional little spots on Fallon where it's always also like a dad thing. Like it was specifically like a dad squad for Bob Odenkirk when he was on the show. And the other week was a thing like I was a summer dad arguing with another dad. So I guess that's like goofy dad, but with a beard. So, you know, cast.
that was the name of the character, Goofy Dad, but with a beard.
With beard, to distinguish from Goofy Dad sounds beard, you know. So, and those kind of gigs are, you know, of course, everyone says that I like to do more of that. And it's the only thing that's scheduled that works around books, of course, because it's only ever a couple of days here and there. And I generally build my schedule with enough time for a couple of days here and there for that. And it's, you know, assuming that it works out okay to go do the audition, you know, which is a 2.5 hours hole in my reading schedule, you know. So but if it works out, it's, you know, it's you know, I always keep saying, oh, I need to focus on doing more of that. And then I ended up doing, you know, I have to sit down to like, oh, I'm going to submit myself for some projects. I end up doing the same thing for audiobook anyway. So I know I need to be more diligent. I need to put, like, for example, those recent spots, I need to actually, like, I have all the clips on my computer. I just need to put them into a reel and do what everyone does with a reel. I mean, put it out there in various formats. But I haven't had the time because thankfully I've been busy. So,
you've got, I mean, now, of course, because of the beard, mm-hmm. you are invariably doctor, scientist, professor.
Yes.
I mean, even other narrators, like when we get together, we comment on
the beard.
By the way, we talk about you. about Professor Hellegers. Yeah. You have that look.
It's also because listeners can't see this, but it's also the beard has a gray on the chin, and that puts about 10, anywhere between 5 to 10 years on me, which I think translates to experience and wisdom when it's really
so
just a lack of pigmentation. But
it's the glasses. It's the whole package, right? I mean, like in my mind, every jacket you own has leather patches on the elbows. That's just how it is.
Yeah, I mean, they don't, but the notion of them is that they do, you know. What is it that Homer Simpson did? He put corduroy patches on a leather jacket. That's what I would prefer that. Corduroy arm elbow patches on a leather jacket. Yeah, that would be my thing.
But then you come home and you go into the audio booth and
can't wear that jacket.
You know, but suddenly the beard doesn't matter, right? Now you're anybody and everybody. And I'm like, how have you ever consciously thought about that transition from, you know, I step out, because you're an actor in both places. Mm-hmm. You're, you know, whether you're on stage in front of the camera or in front of the microphone, you're acting, but, you know, you step out of this magic little box.
Yeah.
And you are, you know, Professor Hellegers. And then suddenly you step in here and, you know, you're everybody. I mean, I'm listening right now to Tempest Investigations.
Ah, yeah.
And I want to talk about this later on.
Okay.
But I have to be careful because I don't want you to spoil anything for me, because I'm right at the point where, you know, he just met Michael face to face and, you know, the guy's up on the wall. And so anyway, you know, and it's one of those things where, I mean, I've listened to all of the Domino Finn books.
Oh, yeah.
And I auditioned for that first one.
Oh, yeah, because that was an ACX. There were a lot. It was the deliberative series. I think Joe did, too. And, yeah, I think someone, I know someone.
But I'm so pleased that you got it. You've been doing fantastic with it. And there's that transition, like when, you know, I'd say the first chapter and a half where I'm listening to the book and you're Neil.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you, and I'm picturing you, mm-hmm. and it's, I'm listening to you, and I'm listening to your performance. And then, you know, 15, 20, maybe 30 minutes in, all of a sudden, Neil is just gone, right? I mean, I am transported into the story, and you are then all of these other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't do any stage or screen acting. I just do this behind the mic. And I was wondering today as I was at the gym and listening, does it occur to you? Do you think about how, you know, things are so dramatically different and freeing here in the booth, where you literally can be all of these different people, probably a solid 98% of them, who don't have the leather patches on the elbows of their jackets.
Yeah, certainly not in Black Magic Outlaw world. Well, it became the kind of choice that when I decided that, I've been listening to audiobooks for a long time, and I knew, I was aware, of course, that like this was something that human beings had to make at some point, right? You know, but I was like, once I like really gave thought to it, I was like, that's because... it uses so many of the other skills that like I do dialect work and things like that and vocal placement and all that training that I had in school and in grad school, to really utilize all of that in a way that I certainly didn't get to. I mean, on stage, you know, you can do I've done a lot of crazy stuff on stage. But I don't do that work anymore. Commercial work was all about, like I've kind of already said, about type. That kind of guy you're looking for. And it could be a lot of fun. It could be pretty zany. It could be very improvisational. But also, yeah. And then the TV thing is also about that look that you cultivate and that you get cast for and that works for you and the type of person. And you're in that box. But, you know, doing all of these, it's like, you know, someone say at some point, it's like, I get to play all the characters, you know, particularly the playing women, you know, I mean, aside from, you know, the Black Magic Outlaw is packed with all these great, like the one scene is like a conversation between a Haitian, a Nigerian, and, you know, the main character who's a Cuban American. And then there's like another Haitian in the room just to keep things interesting. So that kind of like differentiating between like, oh, that's French inflected. The one version of that dialect and that's English inflected. That stuff I love. But how often would I get to be doing a mix of those kind of cultural dialects, and like not maybe one of them, but not all of them, you know.
You are never going to be an old Haitian woman in a commercial.
No,
you're just not.
I mean, not, and if I did, I would get to do it for like a minute and then it would be over with, not as opposed to having to really sustain an emotionally connected, and when everyone has their different objectives and their conflicts between each other and have to be developed and resolved and beat out in the same way that you would beat out a scene, you know. In terms of how what happens, but how it's structured. So it feels like, you know, it feels like a good fit for that. And it's fun to be able to do, to really kind of invest in those characters too. You know, a book that I did relatively recently, that is, was my first sort of like legit, like police procedural thriller, called the Thief of All Light. That is basically, it's main two characters. It's Santero and Rain, and it's sort of an odd couple kind of partnering thing that happens. But a lot of the book is her. And I'm reading, I'm like, this feels like this. It's not first person; it's third person. But so much of it was her, and then it switches to his informed third person point of view increasingly as it goes along. I'm like, I guess what they're seeing here too. But it was great to be her for so much and to just be in her head and go about what she wanted to do. And, you know, And though, and that'll be say also, like, you know, the particularities of the genre fiction is that, for example, in the Nathan's Time Like These series, there are multiple versions of the same character from different timelines interacting with each other. Which, you know, it's sort of like, thank God I listened to Babaverse to know how Mr. Porter does that in terms of, like, what drives character voice isn't so much, well, he's got a French-inflected Haitian accent, and he's got a Nigerian accent, which is British-inflected. It's just like, this person has this concern on their mind, and the other person doesn't know what the problem is. And, like, that's the character voice. Even if it's not, I'm not doing anything inflection or placement or dialect or things like that. So, you know. So yeah, all of that stuff. I just really like geek out on art. If it wasn't, you know, I know I'm being very, you know, subtle about it, but then alien voices to create dialects when you're doing that thing in high fantasy when you're crafting out like how everyone's, you know, how this culture is across an ocean, so they can't sound exactly the same, but you're not going to start pulling out, you know. Well, they're Russian, exactly. But you have to kind of navigate all that stuff, too, that happens in genre fiction. I really love as well, too, having the opportunity to kind of decide by voice, giving everyone their own provenance and their own, you know, identity and character and intention and emotion and all of that, too.
You are such a nerd. I mean, that
we all are. I mean, everyone looks around at APAC and was like, look at all these nerds here, nerd, 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 nerd. And someone's like, I'm not. Yes, you are. Like, you're very, like, some guy, like, you're a very handsome nerd, but we're all nerds here. Let's be honest.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. As soon as you said that, I immediately thought of, like, Will Daniels.
I'll be honest. That's like, who I had in my mind as well. Will, you're a very handsome man, but I think you might also be a dork like all the rest of us. But I don't know you. Maybe we'll have a conversation now that I'm talking about you on James's podcast.
You know, I hope he is. Yeah. I hope he's a dork like us.
Yeah.
But oh my God, I mean, he is like picture. Imagine what you think Superman would look like.
That's
Will Darren.
And there's a booth already there. It's amazing. It's perfect. Like no one would suspect a thing. I've never seen Will Dameron in the same room as Superman, however. So, you know.
Well, have you read his book?
No, I haven't. Again, given infinite time, you know.
Right. And, you know, it's not fair.
What is it?
Right. You know, yes. Well, the book is great. He's incredibly handsome. He's a talented actor and narrator. Mm-hmm. It's not fair. Right. It's just, did you play D&D growing up?
I did a little D&D. Yeah. Earlier on, I played D&D growing up.
So if I make a comment that say like he cheated when he was rolling his stats, then you understand what I mean.
Yes, I do. Yes. Yeah.
Nobody gets that many 18s, Will. No. Stop it.
Where are you getting your dice, Will?
Exactly. Yeah. But this isn't about Will Dameron.
No, it's not. It's not. I actually, more than D&D, I was kind of more on the Dragonlance side of that whole equation, which there was a little bit of role-playing. It wasn't as well-developed as D&D, of course, and that not as widely canonical. But do you know, ever read the Dragonlance books? There were about, you know, dragons and there were lances and they were killing dragons. And
I think I remember.
Yeah, but
that.
It had a whole like expansive post cataclysmic culture thing going on. So it was like sci-fi. It was high fantasy post-apocalyptic, which was kind of cool too. But they had their own kind of like stunted version of the same of D&D. And I did some of that. So, you know, probably a little more than D&D, but still incredibly. Yeah, still dorky. Yeah.
So we've talked about your stage and screen acting, your voice acting. You are, one of those rare creatures in the world today, which is a working, successful actor. I'm wondering, what have you had to give up to be where you are today?
I think specifically doing what I'm doing, it's almost like not doing the other thing that I was doing that was good, but it was not sustainable. And I guess I mean by that, by doing Shakespeare. I think when it comes down to that on one level, that I would say that would be one thing. Like I don't get to do Shakespeare anymore. Except when I've somehow convinced the good folks at the Here Now Festival to let me come and do a Shakespeare thing with them once a year. And that's like my one time a year that I get to be like, you know, invested in the Bard again, which is used to be like all I did in terms of teaching and also in acting. That would be one thing. I always kind of feel like Well, when I actually initially went to college, I was convinced that I wanted to become a rabbi. And that was as a result of some pretty intense experiences I had in high school with religion. You know, it wasn't so much it was the culture of Reform Judaism, and it specifically its modes of political activism really appealed to me in terms of how the Reform movement had been involved historically with, you know, for example, like the Civil Rights Acts were drafted at the Religious Action Center, which is the Reform movement's political lobbying office in D.C., like that kind of stuff. And the notion of tikkun olam, which is a sort of a Kabbalistic understanding of healing the world.
Healing the world.
That, like, it was deliberately created imperfectly, and our purpose is to fix the cracks, as it were. Doing a lot of that kind of work, I wanted to be doing a lot of that kind of stuff, and I wanted to do it as a rabbi. And it became pretty quickly clear to me upon arriving to college and with a full load of religious studies and psychology courses that it wasn't, you know, it wasn't what was working right for me. And I had been doing, you know, theater since I was a little kid. And so when I got to college, I was going to do, you know, shows, of course, in terms of extracurricularly, but slowly but surely my focus shifted into like, no, the way I want to, you know, be it through theater or theater education, to have a direct social impact in terms of helping everyone understand more about themselves and the world and history and culture and all those things, was theater the better vehicle for me, because I was never that much of a traditionalist religiously. I was never much of a, you know, I never, yeah, as a growing up Jewish, bar mitzvah and all of that, but I was never, you know, it was also a matter of like our household, coming from my dad's side of the family, his mom was Catholic, his dad was Protestant. And so, and that's not happening on one side, and my mom's side of the family was Jewish. And since I came out of the magical Jewish womb, I was Jewish. And was raised that way. And I'm glad for all of that foundation, but I moved away into theater, and that became the thing, and blah 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 blah. Part of me does wish that what I was doing on a full professional basis was more of a direct social action impact. You know, I like the idea that there are ideas contained in these books that might be instructional, educational, if particularly for nonfiction. You know, there's great, like one of the first books I ever did, Dreamland by Sam Quinones, is this great book about the history of the heroin epidemic and how it started, how it combined with the from Big Pharma and all of that. But still, it's not the same as working on a local level directly with communities. I know I can always do some more of that, but it's not what my full professional focus is right now, that is invested in supporting my family and career and all those kinds of things. So it's not, I mean, that's like, you know, in the alternate timeline, there is a Neil, I guess, is probably doing all that. And, you know, who's probably saying, yeah, but I always like being in plays. I wish I could do that more often. and so, you know, God bless that guy. But, you know, that's, I would say that's, you know, some kind of mode of career or calling that could have more of a direct impact than I sometimes feel like I'm working through using obscure tools to try to do the thing that I could have been doing in a direct manner. You know, it's not a regret so much as it is an awareness of that other timeline, I guess. You know, again, this is one of the pitfalls of doing, you know, time travel fiction, is you start thinking like, oh, all of my choices led to different things. Like, what's happening over there? You know, what if I had that sandwich instead of that sandwich? How would my life be different in 5 years? Mm-hmm. It's all about sandwiches when it comes down to it.
Do I get the wrap? Do I get the open face? So, all right. You mentioned briefly, very, very briefly, almost snuck it in there, esoteric Judaism. we talked about multiple timelines. I have to ask. Well, I don't have to. I want to ask. I'm deeply curious. Where do you fall, Neil Heligers, on the various realms, issues, things, people, whatever, supernatural in general, ghosts, you know, vampires, zombies, whatever?
In terms
believe,
of
believe, don't believe, you know, that whole thing out there. Where well, are you on that? Are you a complete skeptic? Or
no,
you...
I'm not a complete skeptic. One thing I'll say, the first thing that comes to mind is that when I was a senior in high school, we had a very cool physics teacher, Mr. Goodyear, was a great teacher. And for our senior paper, he let you do like whatever you wanted to do, as long as you could support it with science, you know. And my like senior term paper for my physics class senior year, was the scientific background of ghosts, the sort of paranormal exploration, but also the scientific exploration. And there's, I mean, as you can imagine, there's tons of stuff out there. But the convincing stuff that I kind of put into the paper was having to do with the existence of ghosts, of being maybe not specifically soul free from corporeal form. But in this case, the thesis of the paper was that most ghosts result from violent deaths. And one of the things that happens physiologically at a violent death is that the nervous system goes flash, you know, and so that most hauntings happen in the specific location, specific environment, and specific time around the death or the pattern behavior of that person when they were alive. The widow walking the widow walk, or the guardsman who you know, at West Point that people see sometimes, things like that. And then there were studies where, you know, it's hard to know. I mean, this is also like, we're talking 1994, 95 level of research that you can do in terms of going to the library and getting a bunch of magazines, and the magazines you're going to yank about ghosts are going to lean in the direction of like supporting it. But, you know, they would take a whole house that was quote unquote haunted, put EMF detectors everywhere and see what would happen. And they would find localized EMF fields that would manifest and dissipate around the patterns that people discussed. But they would do things like go down a hall and then make a right. A non-localized EMF field like wouldn't do, like ball lightning. So, but also the idea that when two people can look at the same quote unquote ghost and see completely different things, it's not that there's a physical manifestation because it's just electricity, but it's almost like it's interfering with those individuals' nerve centers. It's like bleed basically into their own nervous system. And that's why they can't be photographed as readily, because the photograph might have some interference, but it's not going to be the same apparatus as the human body. So that this idea in that sense that ghosts are the shadow, the EMF kind of signature of a human being, unaware that they are still, they're going through the motions in that sense of things. So as that, as a foundation of like, you know, there are stranger things in your philosophy than have dreamt of, Horatio kind of way, like there's orders of science and manifestation that we can't know about that happen on some level that might be provable or not. But when you take things from there, it's like, if that is, let's say that exists, then, you know, who's to say that on some level of those apparati are real and some of them are not, you know, some of them are completely fully aware because of the particular conditions where that ghost came into being. So, you know, and that's essentially, it all comes down to energy. I feel like all those things tie into a lot of medicine in terms of, or certainly in terms of Eastern medicine, in terms of, you know, I started doing acupuncture recently, and mm-hmm. I go in there, and I've not read up on it specifically, but I have all this stuff in my head that I was just talking about in terms of the electromagnetic field. And he's talking about it, and he's, you know, he knows it's my first time doing it, and he's talking to me about it like, well, there's this and there's this. I'm like, no, I'm like, I'm completely like, I'm down to experiment with this. I get that these are antenna. I get it. And you're moving energy around and you're reshifting flow and like, yeah, just, yeah. And my lower back had been hurting me, and my wife recommended that I go to the place that she went to. And, you know, I was skeptical going into it a little bit, because I'm like, we'll see how effective it might be. Or one session, I didn't expect anything to happen. And the whole time I'm there, I'm like, my back still hurts. And then I walk out of there and it's like, boom. I'm like, thank you, ghosts, for fixing my back. So once you get into that, I feel like, if that's true, then it also stands to reason that if it is possible to manipulate these energies, and it is possible to, you know, whether it's acupuncture or Reiki or those kinds of things, then who's to say that there's not an additional level that, again, maybe we know about, maybe we don't know about, or we speculate about, or that there are older traditions that certainly invested themselves in figuring out how our bodies worked, like back to shamanistic cultures and things like that. But there's also to say that in certainly in the contemporary urban fantasy sense, that there's not what's going on with that isn't something that is manipulable and that is controllable using the right tools. I do this great series called the Dark Choir series, J.P. Sloan, and it's urban fantasy takes place in Baltimore. And the guy we meet him at the beginning is the curse merchant is, you know, he's a trained magician or sorcerer, kind of varies, but all he's doing at this point is for money is administering curses to various people. And this, the system that JP has in that book and how it translates to how he does magic is not this kind of like, he just pulls it out of himself style that sort of happens. Like everything has to be right. Everything has to be scripted out. The reagents have to be exactly right. The formula has to be particularly right in order to manipulate the energies involved. And he's the point of that series that he, at least in the beginnings, like he's trying to keep things on the light side and not use blood, not go to dark, not go to hexes. And hilarity ensues, but that makes me think that like, okay, so, you know, I mean, if there was a way of doing that, of course it would be an incredibly closely held secret. And, if it came out into, you know, it strikes me, someone pointed this about Harry Potter recently, all these wizards are so powerful, all these wizards. And they don't do a thing on the planet. They don't help anyone. They don't solve problems. They don't, like, cure family. They're like, oh, no, the muggles can't find out. I'm like, oh, guys, if but just, like, a little bit, could you, like, help us out? Just, like, a tiny bit? Like, and stop wiping our minds when things go off, you know? You know, so that I think, you know, how that fits into mythological beasts is a different story. I think like there's probably a lot of, you know, evolutionary dead ends hanging around here and there, you know, that have been seen or various points. And, you know, whether that is, you know, Loch Ness or Bigfoot, I don't know. But certainly there are, you know, creatures out there that, you know, I'm not talking like Megalodon. That's actually the book. One of the book I'm working on right now is even though there's that movie, The Meg, coming out, this is a book series called the Mega. And it is also about a Megalodon. Though it is also about Leviathan Melville, which, you know, is there as well too. Tim Campbell, I guess Peter Burko as well. But so I don't know about vampires, that sort of level of thing, you know, non-humanoid, other evolutionary, you know, developments that may have occurred that, you know, I guess I'm more skeptical about that, but less so about, you know, but again, that who's to say that, like, if everything else I'm saying about, you know, specific brands of sorcery sort of reworking reality in certain ways, I guess anything is really possible in terms of what can result from that or what has resulted over those traditions as they've existed for presumably thousands of years in various forms or not. So,
So to summarize then, what I'm hearing is ghosts. Yes.
Yes.
Magic. Yes.
Yes.
Cryptids.
Yes, yes. Definitely cryptids.
But vampires agnostic.
Mm-hmm. Until I meet one, and then at that point, I'm probably fucked.
Right, yeah. I mean, that's one of those things where, like, oh, now I know, and then you're done.
Then you're right. Done, or you have that horrible secret, like, oh, now I'm a vampire, and, like, how am I going to... This is going to change all, like, my social relationships. Like, how am I going to bring my kid to school? I'm not going to bring my, you know, unless...
But think how much easier then working at night becomes
for you. That's true. That's true, you know. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. All night long. What are you trying to tell us, James?
You're going to have to give up that swell tan.
That's true. And I won't photograph. So no more more film work for me. Tan. Yeah, right. Would a vampire's voice record if they're if they can't be seen? I don't know. I do think, though, that if vampires do exist, all of those things. What's the story that does a lot of this kind of thing? They put out these myths to deliberately throw people mm-hmm. off. Oh, wasn't it in Lost Boys where they were like garlic? You know, that's not a thing. You know, like, you know, they sort of like, but like try some holy water. That was a thing that worked. You know, if there are these creatures, they don't exist anywhere near to the mythological generalizations that we know of and of like whether it's Nosferatu or, you know, Dracul or sparkly vampires who live in the northwestern United States. You know, it probably doesn't happen like that at all. And the real vampires are like, no, man, that's not what it's like at all. You know, that's really the kind of thing that's going on. The most recent Domino Finn had a different take on vampires, that they weren't like, they, you know, they weren't blood feeding. They weren't necessarily, you know, they're in the same way that we think of. They could be in sunlight, but then they couldn't utilize certain talents and things like that. But and they were like anyone else, just trying to get by, you know, in a way. They have a, you know, they're people, they're humanoids too.
Just a guy trying to make it.
Yeah.
And, you know, a vampire.
Yeah.
It happens.
Yeah. You know, to the best people.
So, you know, I ask everybody this next question, but most people don't know it yet because I've only got like two episodes up.
So I couldn't possibly have prepared.
No, you couldn't. However, I'm, you know, based on the fact that, you know, the discussion we've just had, the fact that going into college, you were thinking about becoming a rabbi, but then your senior year, you wrote a paper for your physics class on the science of ghosts. I think I know what the answer is going to be to this. Were you a weird kid?
I wasn't weird out. I mean, like, I had, like, you know, purple Doc Martens, and I had, like, I was kind of a little punky here and there, and just you and me, to be honest with me. and probably, like, I was, you know, listening to more, you know, like, I was a drummer, and, like, I was doing that whole thing and playing with, like, hanging out with the rock, you know, the kids who played in rock bands and things like that. But I was also, like, student council guy and, like, you know, band and choir and, like, you know, I had to kind of, like, you know, it's more like a wearing a few hats kind of guy than like a,
so you were in the closet weird.
Maybe, you know, I mean, but I don't know if, like, I don't know how off, like, truly, like, I wasn't a rebel. I wasn't like that kind of punk, certainly, you know, and then whatever music I listened to, I never took as an indication of my, like, character, just because I would listen to sort of, like, you know, I never went even full on death metal, but, like, you know, pretty lots of different kinds of, you know, rock. But then also I was also, like, playing timpani. And so I was listening to a lot of Shostakovich, you know, at the same time. So I was like, you know, when I was in high school, certainly. And I was in marching band. I couldn't be too weird. And I don't know, actually, maybe that's not true.
Oh,
we had plenty of weird kids in the marching band.
I was in marching band. You could be weird.
Well, the drum line in the marching band were all of my, like, my friends who are also drummers, but also my other friends who were guitarists and bassists who wanted to play in jazz band. The deal was you had to play in marching band if you wanted to be in jazz band. So they were going to learn how to play saxophone or something ridiculous, but they're all like the bass drummers and cymbal players and things like that. So we had a good time. So I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't say I was so eccentric, you know, because I think part of me was always like, I was sort of outward facing and inward facing at the same time. You know, like never always an extrovert, never always an introvert, you know, and I was doing theater too. So it was like kind of in that sense as well. But, you know, I guess I was more on the geekier side of weird, certainly, than the obscure, you know, there's some weird things in his closet kind of thing. You know, I mean, I never killed a man.
Allegedly, or
no,
you know,
they
so
can't
far
prove
as we
it.
Know.
No. Yeah.
Right. No bodies were ever found.
No bodies were found. And maybe they weren't even real people. So, you know, who knows? But, you know, I guess, you know, within the grand scheme, you know, I was lucky to grow up in an environment where you can kind of be wherever you wanted to be. And my parents were accepting of who I was, and my friends were along the same lines. And so, you know, in a different context, yeah, probably deeply bizarre. like, you know, and, you know, what's he doing, you know, but I think that was the thing. I was like, I was moving through different circles of things, you know, in terms of what I was, you know, in terms of music, in terms of school, in terms of hobbies and things like that, you know. Not like chicken head biting weird, but, you know, my own brand of that, I guess. I like chicken a lot. I mean, I make a really good, like, herb chicken with, like, a rosemary and thyme. You kind of grind it up and mix it with a little bit of butter and, you know, put an onion inside. It's, you know.
Cooking with Neil, but not on the subway.
Not in 1972.
Excuse me. So are you weird now?
Yeah, well, I'm sitting in a box in my... We're all weird. I'm just sitting in a box talking about the imaginary voices of books that we read all the time. So that's pretty weird, but respectably, you know.
It's adaptive. You've made a living.
Right. If you can harness that weirdness, it probably manifests itself as some kind of discipline, but it's very useful. You know, I think about that a lot too, in terms of books, just in terms of like, how that the balance of control versus spontaneity, you know, there's a thing about being on stage where within certain guidelines, because the show has a structure and has to move on, but there is always a lot of room for, impulse work. And I guess for a long time, it's taken me a long time with an audiobook to get that feeling in with what I'm doing and not plot things out in terms of like this voice is like this, this is happening here. But, you know, about trying to do prep that's sufficient, but not over prep so that the book is, you know, set out with an inch of its life so that some of that weirdness can pop out in there and give a different unique read to something or a relatable one too, like a human one rather than like a mechanized one, you know?
Yeah. See, and I think that's the key. I mean, that's, honestly, when I listen to one of your books, that's one of the things I love about your performances it doesn't feel dry. It doesn't feel, scripted out to an inch of its life. It very much has that that kind of intimate feeling of like theater in the round, kind of where you are all of the characters, and I'm just kind of I get to sit there and watch or listen to you inhabit all of these different people, but it always has that almost a dangerous sense. You know what I mean? Like, because in theater, anything can happen. Right. A prop can break, a lighter won't light, somebody falls, whatever, you know, so there's that element of danger, anything could happen. How are they going to respond? It's very much, you know, that moment that the actors and the audience are creating together. That's never going to happen again. And I get that feeling from your audiobook performances, right? Even though I know, like in the back of my head, I know the book is written. We know how it ends. I could even read along with, but it's alive enough that it has that kind of intimate, dangerous, oh my God, anything could happen right now kind of feeling.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
I appreciate that you bring that to your performances.
Well, yeah. There's been times where I've you notice as you know enough live theater and you notice there's a weird thing that happens when like I for a few years I did outdoor Shakespeare and things would go wrong or it'd be raining or something. And so we'd add something like when I do this big cross across the field upstage of the playing area, I'll have an umbrella. And then that night I would be able to work the umbrella into whatever that character was doing. And it's this thing about like whenever we acknowledged that it was raining, the audience was like, yes, we're all in the same place. And they loved it. It's kind of like, you know, there's a thing that happens sometimes when actors crack up with each other because one person's just being too funny. The audience, it may break it breaks the narrative in a certain respect, but really it does that thing that live theater is great about live theater in terms of like, we are all really here. Like these things are really happening and anything could happen. You know, I guess I feel like I want to try to keep that sense in the book somehow while keeping things clear, like intelligible. You know, I can't rough it up too much because there's ideas to be communicated and the writing certainly needs to be respected and honored, you know. But if you can get to that feeling where they're like, not that they're like, all of a sudden, like, oh, I'm aware I'm listening to an audiobook, but I guess what you're saying, thankfully, and which is why I guess I'm explaining in long form why I appreciate what you just said, that sort of the feeling that of anything can happen. And I guess I feel like whenever I've tried, you know, I try to work that kind of working method in, it just basically means more pickups for me in terms of like, yeah, all right, I know. Okay. You know, like I get, you know, I'll clear that up, you know, thanks guys, you know, but,
yeah, they frown on ad
libs. Yeah. You know, you're often tempted to just to sort of like comment on the book or something, but then, you know, of course that will end up in the final edition and someone will talk about it in a review. But I've noticed that this is also true with Shakespeare, is that when I was first doing Shakespeare, I'd mark the shit out of the text. In terms of like the meter and then the breaks from the meter, which is really where the important stuff happens, and emphasizing certain verbs and things like that. And then as time went on, I whittled that down. And then almost like I would have one script where I would do that once and then put that aside and then just work with the open text. That's kind of been what's happening with books too. I highlight all this stuff, drop in all this, you know, and there are certain things that I make sure to keep in prep and that keep things moving in the booth, like pronunciations of, you know, obscure words or words that I always forget exactly how they should be pronounced, even though I've said them a million times, or plotting out to a certain extent voices. But then a lot of that stuff is only the stuff that's really necessary stays, and everything else kind of falls away. And so that it can still feel to a certain extent like, yeah, that I guess that anything can happen. But really for me, that I can feel that anything can happen while I'm doing it, to keep that person a human being, to keep guard number three a real guy, even though he's like, hey, get over here. You know, he's got concerns, like he's got to pay his bills. That's why he needs that guy to get over here now, because if he doesn't, he's going to get fired or possibly killed, more likely killed. And then what's his family going to do? You know, he's a henchman, but he's got a life. And a South Boston accent, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. So before we wrap up, there are two things I want to talk about. One, I mentioned Tempest Investigations. Yes. And so at the beginning of that book, is sort of the introduction, I guess not really a prologue, it's more of an introduction, where the author is explaining his intent behind the story.
Behind the collection, basically, in a way, too. Yeah.
Right. And the idea is that it's very episodic, mm-hmm. you know, like a TV show, basically, where you have your weekly episode, you know, and you've got a story arc, you've got some standalone episodes, but that's really what he was going for. With that, and I'm curious, how did you find that that slight change in the author production?
Something he says in that same little intro is about how, imagine that every episode has a different director. That spoke to me in terms of like the TV that you watch is sort of like we live in an age of show running, of course. And so there's tons of consistency in terms of tone and story, obviously, and character. But there is sometimes that slightly different flavor when someone does it. And I don't just mean like, well, they let the star direct this one, so we'll see how it goes. But I just mean in terms of like different people who come in, and I guess having worked a little bit in TV, you know, and having met these people and seeing how they interact with the talent on the show, you know, you can see it on certain sets, you know, when it's like there's a dominant character who's been in this is the, you know, this is series nine, this is the ninth season rather, and this person is in charge, even though there is a director, and that director is nominally in charge, but the person really in charge is the person you're doing the scene with. So it's that particular kind of dynamic. So it's a character in the story, but they're also at the helm at the same time too, as being how I think there's five chapters in that book. And so each one is a different, like an episode. It has a beginning, middle, and end. They connect. There's an arc of sorts that go through the whole season, as it were. But that I would let each episode take on its own character in a certain way. And a lot of that was driven by whose third person informed narrative was driving that particular one. It moves around a bit too, but then the characters grow and the situations they face are sort of developing, like ones, you know, involving sort of a time travel. I don't want to spoil anything for you, James.
Where I am.
I do,
in this book.
I'm parsing what I'm trying to say carefully. And I think a lot of that third person informed, you know, approach is something that I, you know, like to work into everything that I do in terms of who is the narrator, what voice is that narrator versus, you know, Will Patton does this in his Stephen King books that I've listened to, you know, from the beginning of the chapter going into it, like who this is going to be even before the name comes up. You're like, oh, this is this guy in this chapter. Oh, now we're in this guy's head, even though it is third person. And it's a weird kind of a hybrid of those two different things. But with Tempest Investigations, kind of let that drive a little bit in terms of the different stories. And then, you know, like anything else, like in theater, just like trusting the sort of the mythology that in the world that he's created and kind of going along with it. And, you know, letting the main thing, I don't think this is a spoiler, but the main character is not been able to die for a long time. And so he's a bit of a throwback. And how he interacts with contemporary characters is, you know, a lot of the conflict comes in from that and, you know, what he decides he wants to do. And well, you'll see what happens, James. I can't talk about it because I don't want to ruin the experience. Yeah.
You know, I'll have you back on as soon as I'm done with the book. Loving it so far. Really, really enjoying it. Well done. And then the other thing I wanted to make sure and bring up was Archangel.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Which comes out tomorrow, I think. I think it releases tomorrow. Yeah.
And this is a big Audible full cast production.
Yeah, this was it's William Gibson. It came from it was once meant to be a screenplay, and then that got turned into the graphic novel, and which was from a few years ago, and then recently Audible Studios in Newark have built some new, they've been in the process of building new studios for a while. And while they were doing that, they built this, you know, larger, very well-appointed studio that you can have, there's a booth through the window, but then there's room to set up, you know, I think there was like 12 or 13 different stations to do multicast. And they've been doing multicast, but breaking it up or doing smaller groups and things like this. But this week it have all of us there, and it was, you know, 3 days of, it felt like doing a TV show because they had all of us kind of show up and hang out, and then we would pop out in groups to do our scenes. But, and so I'm, you know, playing a couple of characters that are more consistent than a lot of other small characters. And it's a great, another time travel, storyline. I can't wait to hear what they've done with it because it has all, it's, you know, a bells and whistles production in terms of sound and, all that stuff.
Well, and you weren't there in the booth for the whole story.
No, yes.
So.
Well, and I read the graphic novel and the rest of it, but how it sounds certainly, too. And everyone's work is, we had a ton of fun doing it. We're kind of like, this is a great gig. And like, look, other human beings, amazing. And they're also doing, yes, right. Yes. And you know, and it was, again, it was, like I said, it was a nice brand new studio. That was admittedly, I won't lie about that. That was nice too. And, I'm looking forward to hearing it and see how it goes. And again, it's William Gibson. So it's sort of like from reading a lot of his stuff. It's, that's kind of nice. So, I think it comes out tomorrow. So I'll have to check that out.
I've got it pre-ordered. Yeah. So very excited about that. All right. One last thing before I let you go. Anything you wanted me to ask you, anything you wanted to talk about that I didn't get to, or that people generally don't ask you about anything.
Well, we come.
What do you want to talk about?
Let's talk about raising boys for a second.
I know.
How do you? I'm turning it around a little bit. In terms of like, I've been coming across this recently because I want to tell him like the books that I'm working on, and like, for example, I'm working this one about a megalodon, and he, of course, being, he likes dinosaurs, of course, though megalodon is really a shark, not really a dinosaur. How do you, in terms of the really esoteric stuff, I know one of your sons is considerably older than the other. Relatively speaking, in terms of like these kids,
I have a 13-year-old who is going on 45. Right.
he listens
to this podcast too.
Oh, okay.
By the way, so,
okay.
So, yeah. Hey, Dogan, we're talking about you, man.
About like how far do you like in terms of like, you know, I guess this is talking about like some of the weird stuff too, right? In terms of like, being able to talk about what's possible out there without limiting the possibilities of what's in the universe, but also not freaking them out so they not able to sleep at night, because I've seen that's happened sometimes that I've mentioned something that he saw, like, went like right, like some friends of ours came over and we had just moved into the apartment we're living in now. And it's, the building is kind of old, goes back to 1840s. And so like being kind of friendly about it, my friend was like, hey, Eggert, are there any ghosts here? And he's like, I don't know. And then for a while, the wake ups were all about, I saw a ghost. And so I had to go into the like, okay, here's what a ghost is. So I wrote this paper and it's really just energy. And to this day, if I ask Ed, you're like, what's a ghost? He's like, energy, you know, like, great. You know, but how do you, what, to what level do you expose them to, you know, the esoterica and, you know, and the, you know, which, you know, it's nothing is good or bad, but thinking makes it so, but like, you know, how do you approach that? How do you lay that out? Particularly for the older one, I guess I would say.
Right. The Simon, the 3-year-old, he's pretty much cool with, you know, just daddy reads stories to people for a living. That's his level of involvement. Dogan, my 13-year-old, 3 and 13. That was planned. you know, he's on the one hand, I mean, he's incredibly, like, dangerously intelligent, super science nerd. I think I can say that. I think that's okay for me to say that with him listening. I don't think his friends will listen to this. So,
but being a science, but isn't that cooler now? I mean, isn't that something that's changed about the world? Is being, you know, woke and smart is better than being, you know,
And he goes to a great high school. He skipped a grade. I think he skipped like third grade or so. I don't know. It's like third grade was for chumps. Sure. He was just going straight to fourth. He's 13, but he's going to be a freshman this year. He's been at this high school already for a couple of years. And it's a great school. Basically, they're all nerds. They're all just super nerds. They're, you know, they're required to take a certain number of years of Latin. It's a very supportive environment for his high intelligence, super nerdiness. And we actually talked recently, not too long ago, about the existence of ghosts. And he actually gave not quite as eloquent as what you described, but, you know, kind of like the same thought process along the, well, you know, energy can't be created or destroyed. Yeah. So life energy has got to go somewhere. There's all of this recorded phenomena. He actually went on a ghost tour of Cincinnati with me and fellow Cincinnati narrator.
Oh,
Joe
yes.
Hempel.
I think I saw that. Yeah.
Which it was a lot of fun. And Joe, I mean, Joe does just a ton of like horror and stuff. So it was cool to have him there, but it was also really cool. Yeah. To bring Dogan along and to kind of, I mean, he is well aware that his father is a super nerd, you know, especially as far as, you know, my weirder, more, urban fantasy, supernatural interests, you know, my statues of Dr. Strange around the house, my odd statues decorating inside the booth, all of that.
The casting
sort of stuff.
Circle underneath your rugs. Yeah.
Right. You know, he knows what he can talk to dad about, what he should, you know, maybe not let his friends, you know, don't go over
if
into dad's
office.
There's
a line of salt on the ground. Do not mess it up. Do not.
Exactly.
It's there for a reason. It's going to save you. Okay. Just don't break the circle.
So, you know, so on the one hand, I think he's like, you know, I think he's highly skeptical of a lot of things, but, you know, when it comes at least with the ghosts, he's like, you know what? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I could see that, you know, and so, you know, me thinking, of course, I'm like, that's my total thing.
Right. Because that's kind of what I was saying before. Like, if that's true, that's something that is largely generally scientifically not accepted fact in terms of like, you're not going to, you know, come across that in mainstream science. If that's true, then how can you say that other thing isn't true? And if that's true and so forth and so on. So, you know, I think that's as Edgar gets older, I definitely want to sort of like, you know, let him go his own path. You know, like it seems like he might like he's better at sports than I or my wife ever was. And I think that might be his form of rebellion, is to be like an athlete and be like, yes, I'm in support of this, but I can't, I'm terrible at Frisbee. that he is, you know, and it's certainly I can see it reflected in like the kind of, you know, shows or movies he wants to watch, you know, obviously a lot of action, things like that. I try to steer him towards some things that are more interesting, you know, that might be more fulfilling, but while, you know, including some standards, but that, you know, I think it's going to be about that environment as he gets older, that's supportive of whatever weird direction he wants to take or not. If he's going to be like an all-star soccer player, then that's great too. If he, you know, wants to go some other direction, that's also awesome.
Oh, you know, so Dogen just came back from band camp last week and get marching band this year.
What does he play?
Trumpet. Yeah, he, my wife started him on cello when he was three. because
no, yeah, you should, anyway. That's what you're supposed to do. People who are professional cellists, like they start when they're that age. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you know, and there are so many huge, huge mental and emotional benefits to, you know, to playing music from an early age as the brain's develop. Anyway. But he managed to switch to trumpet, you know, right around middle school. But, we watched The Sixth Sense Saturday night. It was his first time seeing it.
Had he culturally been built in? Did he know the thing? Did he know the twist?
No. All he knew was one. This was M. Night Shyamalan's only good movie, and you know the Icy Dead people.
Oh, he just
right. So that was it. So he thought the big reveal was, you know, 2/3 through the movie when he finally admitted to seeing ghosts and everything. Uh-huh. And I was like, you know,
you're like, oh, totally.
But, oh my God, watching him have to pick his jaw up off the floor when he realized, oh my God, spoiler alert, Bruce Willis has been dead the whole time. It's so satisfying. It was great watching it with him again. So,
yeah, I think.
Or watching it again, but with
him. I mean, I think there's certain movies where it's curious what he really kind of takes a shine to. You know, it's all you know, he's five, so there's not, we can't kind of just put anything up there. I sort of keep thinking about Star Wars. Like, I kind of want him to watch Star Wars, but it's also like there's that thing that everyone points out about the end of, you know, Episode 4. It's sort of like, a lot of people are going to die right now, like on the Death Star, like a lot of pilots die, and it's just like it's not gory, of course, but it's saturated with death. And not that, you know, that's absent in some respect, but not in that volume, you know, but certain, you know, or like, I even mentioned like, well, I think the Harry Potter movies, but my wife was instantly like, no, we're going to read the books first and then we're going to do the movies. I'm like, you're right. I'm sorry. What was I thinking? Yeah, absolutely correct. You know? I'm constantly wondering like how far can we go with what's interesting here? And, you know, like he loved, I mean, along those lines of like, you know, he loved the movie Ghostbusters, you know, he was all about it for a while. He particularly likes this,
the
original,
the
like
one?
the 84, or 85, 84. Yeah. It's also mostly like, he really likes that song, the Ray Parker Jr. song. Like he's off, you know, like Echo, play the Ghostbusters theme. And we hear it a lot, or in the car, like, can we listen to the Ghostbusters theme? Like that's been pretty steady. But also, you know, there's, you know, and buried in that movie, there's a lot of zaniness, of course, but buried in there is a lot of esoterica, you know, about the structure of the building. You know, and you know, he's taking like one step over. It's always all Dan Aykroyd. He was all into that kind of stuff, apparently, you know.
I think, though, that a lot of this media is, to steal a term from like esoteric Buddhism, it's self-secret, right? I mean, like you get out of it what you're able to get out of it, kind of like what you're ready for, you know what I mean? So if you're five, you get the Ray Parker song. You know, it's and then, you know, when you hit 13, it's, you know, oh, Sigourney Weaver's in this movie.
And, there is no Dana, there is only Zool.
So I don't know. I mean, I saw Star Wars when I was seven, but that was when it came out. That was actually my first movie ever in a walk-in theater, and that's how old I am, is that they were differentiated from what we now call a drive-in theater. They were so new, they were called walk-ins. That was a big deal.
The first one I saw in the movie theater was Raiders of the Lost Ark. And so, you know, there's lots of bang, but, you know, obviously a lot of death. And then there's the Nazis' faces being melted off, you know.
Right.
Which sets an interesting precedent for a young Jewish boy. But that's like another one you listen to later on. You're listening to, like, you know, later on, like, it was years until I saw it later. And then even until, like, well, I mentioned my rabbinic period, where I'm like, they're saying the Kaddish kind of, sort of, you know, the prayer for... There's different forms of the Kaddish, but he's saying the Mourner's Kaddish is the prayer for the dead over the Ark of the Covenant. And of course, you Nazis must melt and die. yeah, that's right. Throw some Mourner's Kaddish up there, Reich hearts. Anyway, so I mean, it'd be interesting to see how that develops as he gets older and where his you know, his interests kind of develop and lie. But you know, was it Self-Secret? I like that.
Yeah, it's just you. You kind of see what you're ready for, I think, I mean, to a degree. And I mean, in some of these things, I'm not saying, like, you know, at five, it's cool for him to, you know, watch Harry or something. You know, there's nothing secret about that movie. But, you know, especially like, you know, Star Wars, where you've got like the campy kid stuff. I think Raiders of the Lost Ark is a great one because it's got kind of that swashbuckling feel. But then, you know, there's stuff for the adults too, you know, the deeper you want to look into it. And so,
I mean, we've been watching The Sound of Music recently. He's been liking that a lot, and we've watched it a few times now. And, you know, I think that's a movie that I probably also watched a lot, mostly when I was his age and haven't watched in years. And there's all sorts of great stuff actually in that movie in terms of acting, where Christopher Plummer is great in it. You know, like, you know, it's sort of like such a different creature in so many respects. But and then they resolve the whole conflict about I'm going to spoil this about, you know, Maria and the captain. And all of a sudden, there's like the third act, or the last third of it, is all about the Nazis again, the recurring theme. And that's where Edgar loses interest in the movie, because it's sort of, it does feel like they worked it out. And in most, you know, situation, that's like, yes, they figured it out. The meet cute is done. They're together. What a great thing. And then Anschluss, you know, and all the complications therein, you know, in a way, it makes it, I think, raises it above that, all that kind of stuff. But that's where Edgar trails off to, like, can I get a snack? You know, but he does love his Do-Re-Mi's, as he sings it as he goes along. And it's amazing that he sings it. He doesn't know where he's doing this. He's singing it with a British accent. So like, it's not a dia, it's a deer. Like, oh, a deer. Oh, Do is a deer, right? Not a dia, a female dia, you know.
Oh, God. Yeah. Dogen grew up watching, he was born in 2005. And that's, I think, when they rebooted Doctor Who. And so he's been consistently watching it since he came out of the womb. And I think it was like only last year when he realized that we don't call them missiles.
No, the aluminium foil, Mom. God.
Exactly. Oh, man. I want to keep talking, but
format. I get it. Nothing personal. I understand.
Yeah. Plus, you
time,
know,
right. Time. Right. Well, you have work to do, like, James. I have to go to bed. Yeah,
I do. So thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time to chat with me.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate that. And I agree the thing you said, and, you know, just have a nice conversation about the things we do. You know, like we're saying earlier, this would be the hour and a half long obsessive APAC conversation that we never got to have last APAC. So, you know, here we are.
Exactly. And now other people get to listen too, instead of us, you know, going to the corner of the bar and excluding everyone.
And fewer beers involved.
Well,
you're working.
You know, maybe in your booth.
No, I just have my silent water bottle. Here, listen, you can't even hear it. I just drank water. Didn't even make a noise. I can sneak that in between chapters. Anyway.
It's the weird skills
exactly.
We develop. All right, man. Well, I am going to let you go. And again, thank you so much.
Thank you for having
me. We will we'll definitely have to talk again soon. And I want to make sure to give a shout out to our patrons and supporters, beginning with Dogen Foster, C. Stephen Manley, Colleen Jackson, Audiobooks After Dark, the podcast of Paul Stokes, and Zachary McElroy. Thank you all so much. I appreciate your support so much. This wouldn't be possible without you. And if you'd like to support this podcast and get your name mentioned at the end of an episode, as well as a bunch of other cool supporter-only stuff, head on over to patreon.com/sorceress and sign up to support us at the wisecracking wizard level or higher. We'd greatly appreciate it. And that's it for this time. Thanks for dropping by. We really hope you enjoyed it and will come back and see us again. You can find Sorceress on iTunes, Stitcher, and our website, Sorceress. That's Sorcero.us. And you can find me at jamesnarrates.com, where you'll find a list of audiobooks, demos, and all the usual stuff. If you're enjoying Sorceress, please leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher, and if you're really enjoying it, it'd be mighty kind of you to drop a buck or two in the kitty. You can make a per-episode donation by signing up at patreon.com/sorceress, or you can make a one-time donation by visiting paypal.me/jamesnarrates. Any support, no matter how small, is greatly appreciated, and it'll help us keep on keeping on. So until next time, when things go bump in the night, remember to bump back.
The podcast you just heard was published with Anchor. Got something you want to say to the creator of this show? Send them a voice message using the Anchor app, free for iOS and Android.